The Brothers Wiss. The Brothers Wiss, Brothers Wiss. The Brothers Wiss. The Brothers.
You're now listening to Greg. It's the Brothers
Wiss. Hey, everybody. This is Greg with the Brothers Wiss, number 129. Tonight we have Mikey Hammett. All right, let me check my visuals. Yeah, he's straight down. Chicagoland.
Hey, how's it going?
Well, as always, I'm sure they're saying back to the thing. We also have Nick Arellano right over there.
Hi, everybody.
Overwhelm me with your enthusiasm. Caution.
Hi, everybody.
Hey, guys.
Hey, everybody.
Nick's transitioning into ASMR podcaster, apparently.
Yep, coming to a computer near you.
Very, very chill, very close to the mic. All right, let's first talk about our new patrons. We have three this go around. We have Artie Darrell. I think that's the dude out of the Bermuda. No. Bermuda. Because, yes. You know, it's like the Beach Boys song or whatever. He's like the first one. So that was pretty cool. And then we have Norman Jester, as well as Matthew Ogden. So we have three new patrons. You go to patreon.com/your brothers wisp. Throw us a couple of bones, become a patron, help support the podcast, and also get access to the patron-only Slack, where we have interesting conversations about all sorts of things. I think I'll go ahead and read the Cambium plug, and then we'll have Nick use his dulcet tones to tell us about something else. So Cambium, they are still doing the EPMP bundle. Key points are, number one, price. I guess I always start with a price, but I don't know. A lot of people in the Wisp industry are budget conscious. So $6,000 value, you're getting it for just under $2,000. You get 6 months of Wisp.net automated billing. You also get RF Elements twist horns and 2 hours of one-on-one with an EPMP network engineer. No sales pitch. Ask him questions. He's going to answer no matter what it is. You also can grab a sweet, sweet CN Heat trial while you're at it. All right, Nick, what you got?
All right, well, one of the longer sponsors here, Brothers Wiss Podcast, is also brought to you by Sonar, a scalable, intuitive, comprehensive ISP billing and operational support system. Take a look at sonar.software. We've got ticketing, API access, a whole bunch of new features that are coming out in V2. And we're also brought to you by Tower Coverage. If you're not channel planning, what are you doing? Tower Coverage is a RF propagation system to empower network operators to map their coverage area. They also have some integration with some forms on your website to validate leads, which also has integration with Sonar. So check them out if you're not building propagation maps.
Well, if you're not channel planning, what are you doing in your life?
You're right. What are you doing?
What are you thinking? God.
Well, if you've got MOSA, you don't have to plan. Just throw it up and set it to auto. Way you go.
Sweet. Yeah, but does Mimosa send your leads into your Sonar account?
I don't know. I don't pay attention.
Last on the list, we have QuickBit. That's QuickBit.com. They are indoor and outdoor 60 gigahertz kit that is truly set it, forget it. Super simple. Crazy feature set. You get an API, deployment tools, solid distance clients per hub. And they are dangerously close to opening that storefront. I thought that maybe they were going to sneak it in just before we got this podcast done, but unfortunately they have not. So hopefully before the next time we talk to you, it'll be up and we can celebrate it all together. So that's QuickBit.com. All right, you guys ready to start?
Yeah.
Excellent. Silence is acceptance. That's what everybody loves to hear on their podcast.
All right. There's nothing.
So we've got, first I just wanted to say that Nick Braulio, one of the friends of the show, has started a new podcast. Well, I guess he was kind of hosting a previous podcast. That one got sundown, and so he sort of picked up the torch and is moving on again with modem.show. And it really is another networking focused podcast hosted by a much smarter guy than this one is. So probably pop over there and show Nick Braulio a little bit of love. Modem.show. We'll put some notes in there. He, fortunately, he's picked some pretty poor guests here right off the bat. I think the last one had some guy named Mike Hammett.
Yeah, I mean, it's, you know, it must be scraping the bottom of the barrel on that one.
I know, you flip the barrel over and then you just kind of scrape the bottom of that, I think. No, you're talking about internet exchanges, right?
Yeah. Yeah. It was that podcast was actually 3/4 of people that are in our Slack channel. There's Nick Braulio, myself, and then John Osmond. And then there's one other guy. I don't remember his name. But yeah, you know, it was, you know, it's another podcast, but we're still stacking the courts.
Were you spitting some mad bars on there?
Yeah.
Spitting fire, throwing some dope beats at them. That's awesome, man. You know, you gotta share the love. Definitely go and visit that podcast. I listened to the one where they were talking about free range routing. They had an interview with one of the developers, or I guess the community manager, maybe that's who he was. And it was really interesting. I had heard a similar podcast on Packet Pushers, but this one just added a little bit more detail. And Nick's always got a good slant on that stuff, so go check him out. So I was doing a little bit of digging around. I've been, I try not to pull too much from the Slack this go around just to see what else I could find out in the community. And I was doing a little bit of trolling in the Nanog forums, and I found something that I thought was maybe a little bit interesting, kind of just to see what would come out of it. Obviously, it's probably not the best news. So Uganda, you know, the country over in Africa, was looking at doing their elections. And I think the day before, they started cutting out a bunch of social media services. So I think like Twitter, Facebook, a lot of that stuff started getting killed. I'm not 100% up on this, but I started doing a little bit of reading, and it looked like Facebook was suspending some suspicious accounts that were kind of upvoting pro-government stuff, right? Maybe trying to add a little imbalance or something. I'm not exactly sure what happened there. So that seems like that's what precipitated it. Well, just the day, I think right before the election, they decided to cut all internet. So they sent to all the ISPs basically in the country and said, you're suspending all of your gateway connections until further notice. So the internet stopped for what was apparently 5 days. It started coming back online. And it poses a lot of interesting questions, I think. You know, kind of obviously ethical questions about, stopping the flow of information kind of completely in its tracks prior to an election. That doesn't seem like a very fair action. I saw some people talking about it. At what point does this become a human rights violation? And it may already be. What do you guys think about all that stuff? Nick Arellano?
I was like, which of us is going to go first?
Go ahead, Mike. Tell us all about it.
It's a different sort of, like, here in the U.S., you know, we kind of default to, you know, First Amendment free speech is to be protected at all costs, even to the point where we've kind of lost the actual intent. You know, the U.S. First Amendment really only protects the government, or you from the government regulating your speech. But as a society, you know, we take it to nobody should be infringing upon our speech. And so the thought of it from the United States is just ghastly. It's like, oh my God, how could they do that? You know, this is a protected right. We forget that many parts in the world, you have to say exactly what the government wants you to say or else.
Yeah. Well, I mean, not just internet cut off. It could be you could lose your life in some of these places.
Oh, sure.
Yeah, which is pretty bonkers. I was thinking about it, too. I mean, that seems kind of crazy. I mean, it all halted almost simultaneously, so everybody heeded the call over there. I was thinking, what would it take for every provider in the U.S. to just shut up shop? I guess a lot of us are getting transit from somebody, you know, here or there or what have you. So It might, I don't know, man. Even then, it's, because you have, like, internet exchanges, right, where there's a flow of information between those, and they have direct connects to the provider, so I guess logistically, that would be really tough here.
Just government mandate, pop some black box appliances in all the data centers, roll it out after a few months, and then they got the kill switch.
I mean... What, would they just kill power to all the data centers? But you couldn't do that because you would also, like, tank the financial industry and things like that. You couldn't just kill power to the facilities. You'd have to cut... What they were saying, too, which I thought was interesting, is that this order in Uganda also took out, like, all the ATM machines. So you couldn't, like, go and get cash out. So it was... And that's for, like, 5 straight days.
Wow.
All right? So that's... I mean, that's... That's pretty drastic action right there. I mean, it seems like a lot of commerce would just screech to a halt all of a sudden. And that seems unfathomable for a country, you know, just we'll just have a blackout on all trade for 5 days. It, just, I can't even imagine that happening here.
Yeah, so, well, that kind of speaks to the fact that it's not a really sophisticated government or telecom industry,
right?
Because you know they must have just some sort of primitive, you know, I doubt there's a switch on the wall, but you know, some sort of kill switch that just shuts it all off, and that they haven't thought far enough ahead of, oh hey, you know, finance was down, that's a problem, like. You know, it was probably an unintended side effect of, let's shut off the internet. Oh, wait, this other thing happened too. You know, I would expect that if they do this again, which it sounds like their president seems to do similar things each election. So I guess next election we'll see if they learn and, you know, turn that sledgehammer into a bit more of a scalpel.
I think they were. I think I read that in the last election, he shut down a lot of social media. So then there was this explosion of VPN services. So I guess they were trying the same thing, but people were still getting to their social media this go around. So they just had to, you know, pull the hard line on the mainframe to get everything to just stop.
You know, as bad as it is, I kind of see that sort of thing being of lesser and lesser value as time goes on. You know, these, you know, totalitarian, I didn't say that right, but whatever.
total Italian. I got it. Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. Total Italian governments. They are so hung up on being able to control those things, you know. Russia, I saw something, you know, they barred Starlink installations. But people do it anyway. Like, I mean, there's already a ton of illegal, you know, internet installations and things all over these places. It's just now they're going to be a better one. And then, you know, that's just Starlink, you know, once OneWeb turns up their system a bit more, once Bezos launches his, I forget the name of it. I mean, there's going to be 3 competing LEO high capacity services. It's not just going to be, oh, hey, you know, I have this really crap connection and I can get a tweet out. No, like people are going to have
a 10 gig dish outside.
Yeah. Yeah, like, you know, was it, you know, last week they, you know, Elon said something about it, you know, it was going to be 10 gigs is what their new design goal was. So
it's crazy.
I mean, that's more than a lot of these countries had in gross capacity 10 years ago. And now just random people in the middle of the jungle or desert or whatever, they could have 10 gigs. They could go do whatever video of whatever demonstrations or protests or violence the government's, you know, perpetrating, and just there it is. It's up on YouTube or wherever.
It's wild. I just like to think of the logistics of it, because I think you're right. It's probably I think their telecom industry over there is probably just not as developed as a lot of countries are. So it was probably easier to send out that notice to the handful. I saw somebody actually took a picture of it and put it up on Twitter just before, you know, they cut access to Twitter over there. It was pretty kind of like a stock letter that they sent out to everybody. So I guess if everybody turns the switches at the same time, but it's just, I was thinking about just physically attempting to do that in the U.S. would just be, I mean, they'd be bonkers because there's so much connectivity here between, you know, just DIA, transport, dark fiber, and then you've got, you know, all those internet exchanges. So even if you did like cut off all the quote unquote internet carriers everywhere, as long as you can get to an internet exchange, you're still going to get to Twitter and Facebook, and all that stuff is still going to be available until, you know, they would force that stuff down. So if there was something crazy that happened and they tried to, you know, throw the kill switch, it would take a while, I guess, for all of our infrastructure to go down. Although you could, I mean,
hack into everything and leak some routes, cause some chaos for 5 days.
I mean, I guess that's an option too.
True. I mean, yeah. I mean, you know, we're thinking about of, you know, how do we disable the connection from working, but really they could just flood the route tables with /24 announcements.
Don't give them any ideas. Network.
Or just black hole all the top level domain servers or something.
Yeah, I mean, there's a variety of things they could just, boom, done.
Interesting. Let's see. I see down here, Mike, you have something about the Ubiquiti security breach. Do you have some new information about it?
Oh, we talked about that already?
Yeah, we mentioned it last week. Yeah,
well, then...
Remind everyone it was compromised. All right.
Done and done.
That happened.
Well, I mean, I know we talked about like the SolarWinds exploit. But I actually sat through
multiple exploits,
like an FBI presentation, and they went a little bit more into it. And I thought it was interesting. If you guys are keen, I can give you the 2-minute rendition of what they had to say.
Yeah, I'd love to hear the rundown on that. That was a party and a half for them.
Yeah, I'll give you the really fast cliff notes. And some of the stuff they were like redacting. They weren't saying everything, but it was interesting. So they basically said, well, they won't give the full details of how they got into SolarWinds. Obviously, they don't want to talk about that. But what they did say is they got in there as part of the supply chain. And what they meant there was, you know, you have all these developers building code, you know, like in a Git repository somewhere. Well, inevitably, they commit that to be compiled. And then that compiler grabs it, you know, it packages the software up, and then it pushes it over to like the FTP servers or whatever, you know what I mean? Wherever people are going to go and download these updates. So that point between the people writing the Git repository, when it actually pushed to tell it to compile, they basically said that that's where, what was it, like Sunspot or something? I think it was Sundrop, maybe? Sunspot, Sundrop, one of those sun things would actually detect. It was basically watching like the Windows processes, looking for the compiler to start. Well, when it would do that, it would intercept that and then inject its code. You know, it would inject the back door, it would get compiled, and it would push up to the server. So they said in August, they saw basically a little piece of just test code be pushed in, right? Something that was non-functional. I mean, it didn't really do anything. It was just kind of a little flag that they could see. So they waited for that to get out into distribution. Then they, you know, pulled the updates and they saw, sure enough, yeah, it actually, our updates actually got pushed out. Well, then they turned that off. And so then they started actually pumping out the backdoor exploit into the software. So they did that.
Nikki.
Then that started getting distributed for a few months. And then they decided to turn it off, right? Well, the idea is, you know, they only picked up a subset of the customers because they didn't leave. So if you didn't pull an update in that time period, you know, in those few months or whatever, you were completely safe because you didn't get that exploited code. So why not just leave it in there? They said, well, if you leave it in there too long, then it increases the likelihood that you're going to get caught. So that's one reason that they turned it back off. And they said another thing that they did was instead of, you know, the backdoor exploit that they put in there, instead of having it actually do the work. That's why they pulled in, what was that extra exploit that they said was on there? It's like Sundropper or drop something. Anyway, they pulled an extra, I should have had notes in front of me. I didn't actually even think about it until I saw that Ubiquiti security breach thing in there. But they added an additional piece of malware that actually did all the work for them. So it was kind of the piece that was going out to command and control. Well, no, it wasn't. The other one was going to command and control. But it was one that was actually doing malicious stuff on the networks, pulling information, doing all that stuff. The idea being when it got finally found out and caught and they got cleaned from the system, their backdoor was actually still there and viable so that they could continue to impact these people's networks. But then they also said it was really clever code that was in there. So a lot of what security researchers do is they'll take something that's been exploited, they'll put it into a sandbox and write detonate and see what happens. So one of the things it did is it would wait like 14 to 17 days before it initiated, started doing anything. So most security researchers aren't going to sit there that long, as well as most people doing like testing for updates probably aren't going to sit there that long. So they would have never saw that run. But also it did stuff like it would look for DNS servers, like internal DNS servers that were commonly used by security researchers inside of sandbox environments. And so if it saw those IPs for the DNS, it would basically disable itself. So it would never actually activate. They also said it was interesting that if you were coming from any of Microsoft's IP space, then it would disable itself as well. So that if Microsoft was running these tools inside, that it would never exploit their systems, because they figured the security team inside of Microsoft was too good. And so if they caught on, they figured that they would trace it back too fast and shut them down. So a lot of really clever tradecraft, I guess is what you call that, was put into the exploit process. So it was just it was fascinating cat and mouse they were talking about.
It's interesting and apparently quite effective too. I mean, this is one of the worst breaches that there's been, if not you know the most in a very long time. And it's apparently all these little nuances and tricks you were mentioning, tweaks, and they worked.
Absolutely worked. And they also said that, you know, when they ran for that 3-month period, the whole time what they were doing is cataloging, you know, so it would get exploited, it would call command and control and check in. And so they were basically cataloging all the networks they had infected. And also, it would only activate if you had Active Directory in your environment, because they were using like privilege escalation and things like that. So it was just very sophisticated on what it was doing. But they were cataloging all the different networks they had infected and basically, you know, arranging them from, you know, their the targets that they really wanted to hit the most, you know. I guess understanding you have limited time and resources. Excuse me, picking your favorites out of the list and going there. But it's not just those 18,000 that were affected. You know, say you were a prime target and you were also a security research company. Well, then maybe they bunny hop through you to get some other people, right? Some other juicy targets. So, you know, I remember being at one of these FBI meetings. They were talking about like a fertilizer plant in Canada that was being sold. And the Chinese, some Chinese organization was one of the bidders on there. And so they couldn't break into the fertilizer company to like see everybody else's bid. So what they did was break into the lawyers that were representing them and grabbed everybody else's information, you know, what they were offering, what their bids were, so that they could, you know, make the best deal, undercut and all that stuff. So it's so funny how the state actors, you know, they don't always come in the front door. Sometimes they'll take the side window like this. So there's no telling, you know, if one of those organizations did represent something that was interesting to them, they might have gone down that road. So yeah, I assume we'll truly never know the full breadth of that hack. I wonder what it was like. Can you imagine the elation of those hackers inside when they did that first test and they actually saw it get pushed out into the code, like actually on the real internet? I bet, man, they must have partied like it was 1999. Yeah, you know, it's like Christmas, the lottery. You just got like an inheritance from a billionaire uncle you didn't know about. You know, just like all at the same time. It's got to be crazy.
If you just think about the coverage they would have, having access to all the workstations and systems that use SolarWinds, it's like hitting the jackpot for sure.
Because SolarWinds isn't cheap. So
no.
Places that can afford that stuff are definitely the places you want to compromise. Everywhere you want to be. All right. So that's all I know about that. Very vague. I just the points that were really stood out to me were those specific ones. That's fascinating to me. You know, all of the little gotchas that they try and avoid and all that stuff. The cat and mouse of it all. I think it's probably why security researchers like that stuff so much, because it's very fun. In theory, as long as it's not your network, I'm sure it's not fun then. But outside of that. So what else have I been working on? I did a bunch of badgering of Mimecast. It took me about 2 months, but I finally got with those guys. They are like email filtering. A ton of folks use them, right? Where especially a lot of like local government, local and state government use Mimecast. A lot of the big Fortune 500 companies will use that for their mail filtering or whatever. And it does a lot of interesting features like URL rewrite. So if you get links in there, it'll rewrite it to something safe, and it'll like grab attachments and things like that. So it's, you know, still a lot of security stuff. And I finally got them to agree to give me a developer account so I can go and start playing with that stuff. I can automate it against it. It took me forever to get them to do it. They were asking if we wanted to like partner with them and stuff like that. I said, send all the paperwork to my boss. So I don't care about any of that stuff. I'll let him deal with it. I just want the account.
It's like, I just want to play around with the stuff.
Yeah.
Figure out what I can do.
So that'll be cool. So I was talking to a CISO I know, and kind of a day in the life for them is they'll get like a phishing attempt. Well, then they'll have to go to Mimecast and they'll look up, you know, what were the links, and they'll throw them over to VirusTotal, do some checks, you know, just a bunch of like GUI walking back and forth. And so it'll be cool to put together a demonstration of automating all of that stuff. I think it'll be fun. Also, while I'm thinking about it, Splunk Phantom. So Phantom was like a SOAR product. You know, it's kind of like in security. It brings together your SIM, like all of your logging and stuff like that, but adds automation to actually make changes to things as it like detects weird stuff going on in the network. And so I got a copy of Splunk Phantom, so I got a 6-month trial of that, so that should be able to give you enough time to put some demos together. So I'm curious what, here's the thing, I can put demos together, but I don't know what security stuff people are normally seeing or would want to react to, so I need somebody to tell me, well, I guess what, like failed login attempts, that could be one, right, stuff you're looking for and react on. What else can you guys think of? Like a DDoS or something? I guess that could be one.
Definitely harder.
Yeah.
I guess it depends on the service that you host. I know usually failed login attempts for sure.
Yeah.
But it just depends on what stuff you're hosting.
Well, make up some stuff.
Make up some stuff?
Yeah, maybe I'm what am I hosting? I'm hosting web servers. So I bet you I could have like a snort box dumping back stuff about SQL injections or something.
That could be useful.
I like how you're pretending not to know all these devious things, Nick. It's very clever of you. I just don't know any of that stuff.
Yeah, there's a lot of tools and frameworks that help you protect against that stuff already. I mean, I guess if you have good firewall practices and patch your systems, I don't know. You don't really see a lot of stuff except maybe failed login attempts or, I don't know, maybe SSH authentication attempts.
That's the problem. We all think about the world. Well, we think about things like an ISP and not like an enterprise running all this crazy stuff.
Right.
I just need to talk
maybe
to
systems that were
guys.
Contracted out. Or they had somebody else come in and install it and they don't know what's on it. That's pretty common.
All right, I'm making notes here. All right, that's all I got. Mike, tell us about your cage nut tool.
I think, I don't know who it was, but it was somebody in the Little Brothers dropped a link to Amazon for a cage nut tool. And while I don't work with cage nuts often, they are such a pain in the butt that I thought it was worth buying this tool. And I'm sure it's overpriced. It's $20 and some change.
You already got it. It's already in.
Yep, I got it today. I actually bought one both for Justin Wilson and then Scott LaPierre and just sent it to him. I didn't even tell him until it was already there. But yeah, you know, it's just this little piece of aluminum. Well, I guess two pieces of aluminum and a screw. And it just kind of pinches down on the cage nut, and then you can put it in and let it expand back out. I don't know how many times my fingers have been frustrated with me after trying to install the cage nut.
Yeah, and I usually just break them with a screwdriver, just end up bending them all up.
Yeah, or using the flathead, and then it slips, and then you poke yourself a little bit.
Yet,
no more.
Yeah, it's, you know, that, or it slips and you know, your hand goes flying into it, and you rack the server next to you, or the cabinet, or, you know, whatever it is else that's around there, and you become upset.
Well, I mean, the data center gods always require blood sacrifice, so a blood offering.
That's what they say.
It's no good trip without one. So inevitably you're going to bust a knuckle on something and they're jacking around with that stuff. But that's cool. It kind of looks like a pair of toenail clippers.
It does. Well, and so I showed it to my wife and like, that's the first thing she thought when she saw it. She's like, some jacked up clippers.
Maybe if you're going to like clip a horse's hooves or something, kind of looks maybe.
Actually.
That size.
I just realized that with my background, it gets lost. So I guess I should hold it here so people can actually see.
There you are. Yeah, it's pretty neat. I plan on sending a link over to the guys at the data center to see if they can get some use out of it, a little bit more action there. I did some cage nut stuff like a few months ago. Well, November. Yeah. November. And then prior to that, I probably haven't put in cage nuts in like 2 years. So, all right. What else you got on the list, Mikey?
So there's a webinar coming up from CTI / Convergence / Tech / whatever name they're going by now. And it seems to be there's some sort of resale opportunity with AT&T TV, which is the rebranded DirecTV Now streaming service. A big kind of barred entry for a lot of streaming services is that the ones where you actually get involved in the process cost a lot. For the ones that don't cost much, you know, it's because you're not involved at all. And it's just saying, hey, you know, go sign up for Sling and I'll get a, you know, $10 credit or something like that. You know, I don't know what's involved in this program, but it certainly sounds interesting for those that are looking to do TV. Unfortunately for my use, it probably wouldn't work because one of the kind of demographics we're going for is old people. And old people like the standard, you know, 0 through 9 remote. You know, I want channel 32. And they 32 and that's what they get, and I have to remember how to click through a guide to get to whatever they're looking for.
I've seen some old people have pretty good luck with, like, Rokus, things like that, you know, like over-the-top boxes.
Yeah, it's, some are. My wife works at a retirement community, and, you know, she's telling the story of, you know, one time there was this lady. I forget if she was – 93 or 103. And, you know, she was, you know, being taken to the hospital for something, you know, some level went off or, you know, whatever. And the paramedics were asking her about, you know, is there any family we should notify? She's like, no, I already FaceTimed my granddaughter. I've sent an email to this person. And it's like, I know people that in their 30s that can't do that.
She had a macro set up. It's all good.
It's just like, and so, yeah, I mean, you know, there's people that can do it, but, you know, your typical senior citizen is not going to navigate those things that well. I mean, my parents aren't even senior citizens yet. And every time there's a problem, you know, I have to walk over there and, you know, turn their, you know, audio receiver on it or off and back on. So that way, you know, video shows up correctly. It's like, just turn it off and on. And they, I have to go do that. So,
you know what I've noticed lately? This is a bit of a tangent, is that I just felt tired. You know, it's like in my house, I'm always like the guy that fixes everything. You know, so anytime anything hiccups, if they don't feel like messing with it, they're just like, hey, this thing's not working. Sometimes I want a break. I want to just not have to fix everything. You know, I still want to be like, it's part of my personality to like help and be helpful. And like that makes me feel useful or whatever. I don't know what's wrong with me lately. I've just been like, Jesus Christ, can't you just, yeah, okay, yeah, all right, yeah, I'll take a look at it. You know, I can't just, you know, say, yeah, be happy. I think I'm just getting old, dude. This pretty soon it turns into yelling at people, you know, for leaving their trash cans out too long or their grass is getting too tall. I don't know. I think I'm just becoming an old man. But I seem to have less patience for that. Maybe I just want them. Maybe I'm trying to empower them. You think so? Like I'm trying to help them to help themselves. Perhaps that's what it is.
Yet, well, if your problem is that you're feeling that you need to be helpful, I can just text Christy and be like, tell the boys to make him feel useless.
Oh, they do that on a regular basis. Nothing makes me feel better than when my 12-year-old watches me play Beat Saber, and then I take the headset off, and he goes, dude, you are trash. Yeah. Makes me feel great.
Oh, man. Nobody asked you, bud.
Way to build me up, bud. Yeah, appreciate that.
I can go grab some of your drawings from third grade. Now who's trash?
Oh, man, yeah. Kids are there to build you up, make you feel better about yourself. Oh, Lord have mercy. Yeah. All right, well, tell me about some transoceanic cables. That was a tough one for me just then.
Yeah, I would say, like, tell you about Transio. It's a radio company that I think's been kind of been gone for a while, or at least it should be gone.
But not forgotten.
And so this is kind of, what triggered this was this initial news blurb of Orange, which is
the new
kind of the international division. Yeah, that's what I hear. It's kind of the international division of French Telecom, I believe. And they're partnered with Google and some others on an existing transatlantic cable called Dunant. I'm sure anyone that can speak French just choked. So they're following up with a second cable now called Amity. I don't know, whatever. if you want to know, you can just click the link in the show notes and figure it out.
No, keep going. I'm enjoying this. Yeah.
But, and, you know, it's, you know, it's some new, you know, cable system, you know, to have, you know, one was the initial link, second one is a diverse connection, you know, 23 terabit per second per fiber pair, you know, X number of fiber pairs in the cable. And I saw the number of fiber pairs in the cable, and it was 16. And I thought, that seems like a lot for a transoceanic cable. I remember for a long time, it was like, you know, not many were two, but many were four pair. So there were some six, and like an eight pair was rare. And so now you got 16s. And I saw somewhere else there was, you know, like there's many of them that have lots and lots of strands now. For transoceanic, obviously. For terrestrial, it's nothing. It's a joke. It's a drop.
Yeah, it's nothing. I mean, that is like embarrassing if it's just within, you know, some geographic area.
And so then I went and thought, okay, what's the capacity of this new system? And so the design capacity, you know, 16 times 23 is 368 terabit per second. That's a lot. And I thought, let's go back 20 years ago. What were design capacities like for cables built at the time? So the one I looked up was Level 3's AC1. They built in 98. And I'm not sure, you know, so that cable was a whole system. So it was actually two crossings. So I'm not sure whether this number is per leg or for the whole or for both. Its original design capacity at full use was only 40 gigabits per second.
That's crazy.
So then I thought, okay, let's do some math on that. So from 1998 to, I did 2020, because I think that's when the cable was actually announced. Or if not, then, I don't know, AC1 wasn't actually live till 99. So, you know, 22 will still work as my range. But I took, okay, so what's the difference in the size? First, it's a 9,200 times increase in design capacity of the system. From 99 until now. Divide that over 22 years. That's 416 times increase in capacity per year.
That's cool.
You look at all these metrics for, you know, how data growth happens. You know, you look at any WISP or, you know, traditional data center or whatnot. And you see this nice little curve that's, you know, varies between, I don't know, 1.5 and 3 times per year increase. This is 416 times per year of an increase. That's enormous. That's an enormous leap in capacity. Now, AC1 has become much larger. I think it's still kind of Level 3's workhorse. You know, they just, you know, change out the electronics at either end and it does a lot more. But for the original design of the cable, it's like, holy cow, that is a huge increase. And you kind of think about, you know, how would any of us handle a need for a 416 times annual increase? I mean, that would be, I wouldn't even know how to handle that. 416 times increase in capacity every year.
Yeah. I mean, that's the kind of problem only a handful of people in the world have. So it is fairly difficult to imagine that kind of growth.
And then you kind of think about why, you know, why has that gone up so much? I mean, I have what I think is the right answer, but, you know, what do you guys think is the reason why we need such an increase now?
It's got to be the cat videos and cat memes, I'm assuming.
Cat memes are no longer that exciting. Now it's Bernie Sanders in mittens.
Yeah.
All right. The wholesome memes.
Yeah, yeah. I would assume it's our ever-increasing thirst for video traffic. It's just gone bonkers. We're moving that stuff around like crazy. That, and you know, there's an ever increasing number of people online, and just with the just sheer distribution of smartphones and things like that, where it's so much more readily available for us to watch that kind of streaming media and things like that, I would assume that's probably the big driver in it, huh?
Nick?
I don't know why they would use such high counts, but I guess if you're gonna do the thing, you might as well go big, right? Depending on the cost and.
Oh sure, yeah. And so, like, historically, what I've kind of thought was the reason why they had limited strands is that because, you know, there is active electronics throughout the system. Mm-hmm. You have devices amplifying the signal. You know, you can't just have one big laser that shoots a 20,000 kilometer, beam. And I don't know the spacings of them, but, you know, in this undersea cable, you know, you've got a couple little fiber strands, and then you've got huge power cables that then bring power along to each of these amplifiers. And so it kind of makes sense that, oh, if I have 8 pairs instead of 4 pair, I need twice the number of these amplifiers, and then for twice the amount of electricity and twice the, and so that's probably why things were kind of restricted before. But, what caused the reason to why all of a sudden that cost was now something that one can manage? My first thought was, well, they've simply just got more power efficient amplifiers. Is one of them. You know, if you don't need as much power to run the amplifier, you can put more of them in with the same amount of electricity.
Yeah, true enough, that makes sense.
But I think the underlying thing in all of this is the explosion of that hyperscale, content provider, be it Facebook, Amazon, Google, Microsoft, so on. Any one of those companies has more value, has a higher market capitalization than the bulk of the telecom companies in the first world. I mean, they're just working with a totally different set of financials. They weren't building their own things 10 years ago, or at least very little. You know, they were just buying stuff from everybody else. Oh, I need 10 gigs from, one Wilshire in LA over to 60 Hudson in New York. Hey, level 3 and above net and whomever else, what can you do for 10 gigs? And then they, bought whatever worked for them. Now, their internal needs, Microsoft's or Amazon's internal data communications needs probably exceed that of the greater internet.
This article you have here, it's fascinating. It says, just in the intro blurb, it says, the traffic between North America and Europe doubles every 2 years on average. And they're saying this is growing at an unprecedented rate due to the COVID. They're saying after the first lockdown period, it like surged even beyond what they had, even beyond that normal graph. And they were saying the Amatee submarine cable, 16 fiber pairs, up to 23 terabits per second on each pair. I'm assuming they're talking about pair there. It says both these cables will have more capacity than all existing systems currently in service on the transatlantic front. That's crazy.
Yeah, I mean, the new cable has more than all of the other ones combined.
That's bonkers.
And there's not just one new cable. There's many new cables. And if you look at who's, Orange says, Orange, co-investor. That means that it's not just them. Back in the day, Orange would build their own, or they would work with British Telecom, or they would work with AT&T, and they would deploy a cable. Google, is the anchor customer for the sister cable to whatever this is. You know, it's Google and Amazon and Facebook and Microsoft that are getting into these cable systems. And, you know, traditionally these cable systems were a couple hundred million bucks. And so for a big telecom, it's like, you know, that's not an insignificant amount of money. But to Facebook, who's spending between $5 and $10 billion every year building data centers, what's a couple hundred million so they can talk to each other? It's nothing.
Yeah, it's chump change.
It's nothing at all. Yeah, it's just like, oh, you know, building an entire global infrastructure with more capacity than everything already there is a rounding error in their budgets. So they just build more, build more, build more. And if someone else is going to build a cable, hey, you know, you were going to build a 6-count cable, build 16. And I want, you know, 5 of those. And I'm sure, you know, Microsoft wants the other 5.
Yeah. You know, we'll give you all this money. We'll take 5 of the fibers. You do all the maintenance stuff like that. We just want the fibers.
And so it's just the vast scale, and like looking at, you know, how many data centers Facebook announced in the past year they're building in the US. There's 4 or 5, you know, one just up the street from me, you know, 4 or 5 new campuses. It's like, that's, you know, that's just the US. How many more are they building elsewhere? It's like, it's just an enormous amount. And then, you know, they have to connect it all. And it's stuff like this where, you know, we need obscene amounts of, you know, capacity to connect all of the things. You know, I remember a few nanogs ago, Microsoft, I think it was, well, someone from Microsoft did a presentation on, you know, open sourcing submarine cable systems. And basically, you know, because historically it was, you know, somebody like, you know, Infinera or Ciena or, you know, Alcatel-Lucent or someone like that, it'd be their equipment that does everything, and you just get handed off, you know, here's your 10 gig circuit or whatever. And, you know, these, you know, as these hyperscalers have shown throughout the rest of their compute and network infrastructures, you know, they're not happy with just the, just give me the standard commercial service and I'll be, you know, information and I'm good. No, like they want to know everything, you know, they want that finite control, you know, they want, you know, that's, I mean, you know, they build their own switches and switch operating systems just to get the control. And then they say, okay, well, I don't, you know, I release this to open compute projects. Now everybody can do it. And, you know, Microsoft was saying how they pretty much did that on, you know, one of the submarine cable systems they were working with. They said, no, we're going to put our own shit in. And, you know, because they wanted to, that amount of control over, you know, seeing how the light comes in. And it's at a far lower level than things we're used to. I mean, you know, how the waveform enters and all these things. Like, yeah, they want to know what's going on about all those things all the time. And it's just like, I mean, if you went back 10 years ago and said, yeah, you know, Microsoft is going to, you know, be building their own, you know, submarine cable systems, you know, people would be laughing at you. Now it's happening all the time.
It still blows my mind. You know, it's still just like this, indistinguishable from magic technology for me. You know, that it's just like that. I know how all the gears turn. It just still blows my mind every time I really think about the fact that I can ping right now to London and it'll take 100 milliseconds to get there and 100 milliseconds back. And it's traveling most of that way in glass and shooting under the ocean, you know, miles under the ocean, just blasting across and then blasting. It's so unfathomable the amount of power that we take for granted these days.
And you know, also, you know, kind of, you know, on their, you know, building sprees for capacity, it's not just capacity, the amount of redundancy that these companies demand as well. Each of those major companies that I had talked about, they're all involved in multiple transatlantic cables. They're all involved in multiple northern Trans-Pacific and multiple southern Trans-Pacific. They're involved in multiple, South America via Atlantic, multiple, South America via Pacific. Like, there's just so much diversity to building into all these things. It's not just, the oceanic systems, but the terrestrial systems as well. Mm. I know someone who was the fiber contractor for one of the Facebook data centers that was built. There was 5 completely diverse feeds out of that facility.
Wow.
Going for long distances. Not just, okay, 5 vaults leaving the property and then, we all end up at somewhere else within, 5 mile radius. No, like it was long, long builds to make sure that they had the most amount of diversity possible.
That's crazy.
And obviously AT&T doesn't do that. Look what happened in Nashville. Bam. the southeastern part of the country was down for a week.
Wasn't there like a cut up in Brooklyn that crippled some stuff last week as well?
Oh yeah, yeah.
What did grumpy old Matt Verizon say? No sleep till the fiber's fixed in Brooklyn.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah. It's just like, these. And that's why these companies are building their own systems. Because it's like, look what happened if you counted on AT&T or if you counted on Verizon or anyone else that would be in that duct. It's like you're down. And, when you spend $1 billion building a data center, you look quite foolish if a $20,000 backhoe takes it out. So, do everything you can to keep that sucker online.
Mm-hmm. And we're talking about companies who are trying to, provide their service to the world. And so, they're building all this fiber. They're talking about building, these satellite networks to try to get the rest of the underserved globe service with some kind of reliable internet so they can get on their platforms and harvest data. So, yeah, like you're saying, it's kind of a drop in the bucket, but that gives them reliability, allows them to get the information to people a lot quicker when they've got all that excess. So it's an information race now. Mm. So it's time to build out the network to the rest of the world.
Yeah. You know what they say, as far as redundancy goes, 2 is 1, 1 is 9. So you gotta have some backup. That hasn't there been some scuttlebutt about Facebook it becoming a monopoly and having to be broken up somehow or something like that?
Yeah, I mean, all the tech companies kind of are right now. But they're not really sure what to do at this point because they've got so much control.
Yeah, you can't just say, hey, you have to sell off half your data centers. It's sort of not how that works. You'd have to just encourage competition, but I mean, there was competition, like Instagram, and then, they let
they get bought
Facebook
out.
Buy. I mean, they were the ones that right. allowed it to happen. You know what I mean? So yeah. There were some competing platforms.
In the case of Facebook, there was Instagram. There was, what was the other messaging program that they bought?
WhatsApp?
WhatsApp. It's just like,
WhatsApp.
It's...
You're saying it wrong. Right?
I always kind of viewed those as, they're not really direct competitors, but then as time went on, I kind of learned that I was thinking about the product wrong. Like, yes, Instagram isn't a, platform where you share articles and you post
conspiracy theories
text. it's not for news. It's for pictures and short videos. And there's, it's all, to me, fairly, in the realm of social media systems, it's all fairly meaningless content. Most of Facebook is meaningless, but there's something of value there. And then I came to realize that I was looking at it wrong. It's not that they're like the underlying thing that they're competing on is attention. How much time do
Yeah,
you
engagement.
spend in their app? And it doesn't matter whether you're posting long form articles or you're, posting a video or you're in, WhatsApp just doing conversation. They're there to capture your attention, mine your data, sell ads. So, yeah, they all are competitors in that realm, in that world, WhatsApp is a competitor to YouTube because it's the amount of time you spend using the service is what they're is what each service is paid about. It's kind of different than back in the day when it was, Cubs versus White Sox, those are your two competitors. No, it's Cubs versus YouTube. But then it's like, okay, well, then how do you break that up? I mean, the products are barely integrated, but then do you really solve the problem? If Facebook got rid of Instagram and WhatsApp, does that even solve anything? No, it doesn't. It doesn't solve the underlying, crisis. There is Facebook versus Twitter, but again, they're still different enough in the applications where, the people that use Twitter would not use Facebook. The people that use Facebook would not use Twitter, other than, some Venn diagram of people that just cross post. Me being one of them. I post the same content to both services when I, well, mostly. Most of the things that go to Twitter also go to Facebook, other than when I'm bitching about companies. Yeah, so it's like, so what do you do? How do you break up Amazon? Like, do you portion out, like, okay, so you chop off AWS, but then, like, AWS is still the king of, cloud platforms. Amazon then still has the entire shopping and logistics infrastructure.
Yeah.
So then how do you cut that up even more? Do you make them spin off Whole Foods? Well, that really doesn't fix anything. You look at back at the major kind of antitrust things from the past, AT&T in 1983 or four, whatever it was, there were some very clear lines. There was the long distance network. There was, each state had its own network. So you just group some of those states together for the, regional Bell operating companies. And then you have, long haul AT&T and bam, it was pretty clear cut. Standard Oil. You have the oil infrastructure in these various, regions of states. So it was really easy to break it up. How do you break up Amazon? I mean, it's a single website that you go to. How do you break up, the Facebook portion of Facebook? You don't.
Yeah.
Yeah, just from like a management standpoint, like a company that big that kind of grew organically from where they started to where they are now, like you don't get to start a new Facebook. Like you don't get to like join into that game. Like it's already long lost. So and then when you look at like acquisitions and stuff, it's like, does this service have a user base that's not on our platforms yet? So we might as well buy and integrate to get more people into the fold of Facebook. So it's not even, I don't know how you could even like get into that game with these giants. Just let alone the infrastructure, the number of people. Like when we're talking about another platform that was on the last podcast. Like how do you handle the load of social media when anyone can just jump on unless you are these giant tech companies?
Yeah, well, I mean, TikTok somehow did it, right? They came up, but weren't they? I mean, I'm not 100% sure where their money came from, but there was a lot of it there. So,
China.
Yeah.
I'm
if you you got a big chunk of money like that, I'm sure you can. Yeah. You know, I was trying to come up with a, what do you call that? A metaphor, a simile, to this scenario. And I was thinking Facebook is like, the most popular apple in the world, and 99.999% of everybody eats that apple. So if you breed a new strain, what are the odds you're going to get anybody interested? Yeah. I mean, it's like, it's
well, and TikTok
such a
is
rare
just
chance.
Short videos and comments, whereas Facebook is like, you've got all your like groups that you participate in, and it's got like the marketplace stuff,
yeah,
and it's like video section. And it's a lot of stuff in the ecosystem. So like, are you going to build feature parity with Facebook? Probably not. It's a little bit different. I mean, I guess they had stuff like Instagram stories, and now Snapchat's got videos, so now more people are doing it, but I don't know, it's a little different now than when some of these other companies just started.
Well, it's like, I think too, how do you make a competitor like YouTube? How does anybody stand a chance against them? Especially since they acquired Vimeo, you know, which was like the only pseudo competing
product. Oh, I didn't know they did that. Oh, okay. I would say, well, then you just go use Vimeo. But if it's the same, if it's the same boat now, then I guess it doesn't really matter. But yeah, you know, it's just like, how do you do it? Well, you know, people chose Google because it was, you know, Google search, because it was better than Ask Jeeves and Alta Vista and Yahoo. Oh, God damn it, my Google assistant's talking now. And better than, you know, Bing. You know, it's, you know, I mean, Bing knew it was better than Bing because Bing was just copying Google's results for a certain amount of time. So it's just like, you know, when you build a better mousetrap, how do you punish them? I mean, you know, all you can, the only thing you can do, you're like, I think a lot of people are opposed to them simply because it's like, oh, this one company made me mad at one point, and so now, how can I get back at them? Oh, break them up. but like, you know, you have to be then real careful about going out. Like, all you can do then is, you know, go after antitrust type stuff. Like, you know, is Facebook or Google or whoever doing things that, you know, unfairly sabotage right. the competition.
Suppressing competition, yeah.
And then what do? You just give them a fine. Like, you know, make them stop doing it. That's all you can do. You can't break it up. So, you know, it seems like the only way to get back at these companies is just to make sure that you got, you know, really good, you know, antitrust law. And, you know, just follow that. I mean, that seems like the only thing you can really do.
Well, I got to figure these big companies have some pretty good lawyers. And they've probably got a whole lot of money and lobbyists to ensure that, you know, they're fairly well protected.
Well, have you heard some of the, like, at least like when Mark Zuckerberg and, you know, people from Google have actually been put on the stand and have to ask questions? Like, a lot of the Congress people are so out of touch of what, like, these companies do to even know how to, like, assess them properly. Like, If you have time, you should look up some of the questions they're asked. It's like the people in office don't really understand the technology in the first place, and so I don't think
they don't understand anything in the first place, really.
Like asking the guy from Google if you can track me on my iPhone kind of questions. It's like, oh, are you using any Google services? It's like, no, answer the question. If I've got my iPhone, are you able to track me? It's like, wrong company, bud. So they're probably having fun with most of it. I mean, they have to pay a fine. I mean, most companies, they don't even do security audits because it costs less money to pay the fine when there's a compromise than it costs to have a team come in and audit their stuff every year. So
it's
like, it's
cheaper,
just part of business.
It's cheaper to do that than have a full security staff. It's cheaper to apologize
that especially.
Than to maintain the staff that are able to actually prevent that kind of compromise. which is crazy.
But it's like, well, then how do you solve that? I mean, just make the fine bigger. Because who would have thought how quickly does Congress move? Like, if it's in their best interest, they move immediately. But if it's not perfectly aligned with their self-centeredness, then it takes forever. So how big of a fine would have been appropriate 5 years ago for Facebook, Google, whoever? Is that still appropriate now? No. Like, they're so much bigger now. The fine that was appropriate 5 years ago was worthless now. But then at the same time, you can't have a $10 billion per occurrence fine because you want to get back at one of those companies, because then who's going to start a new one? Until you get to that size, you can never afford the fine for anything, so you don't even try. So then, what do you do? Someone has to come up and, there is a solution. It's just, somebody has to do something. And then it'll get ignored by everybody in politics and, won't actually fix anything. But, I don't know if it's some sort of, sliding scale of, X dollars per infraction per user of the service type thing. So now that you've got 2 billion users, your fine is 2 billion times bigger than a person that only has one user. I don't know.
Yeah. I have no idea. I have no idea about much of that stuff. I haven't really put much energy into research or I just hear rumblings every now and then, and just kind of file it away to ask people who have done a little bit of due diligence. Seems like if there was a simple answer, we would have already fixed it. But
it's hard to grasp because, like nobody understands the amount of data that comes in and is distributed by these companies. Like, it's just unfathomable to compare it to something that, like, makes sense, because they're just so big. So they have problems policing their own content. Not that, that should be the answer for some of this stuff, but, like, how would you have a third-party organization audit these companies when they can barely keep up with the stuff that's circulating on their platforms? Business practices are one thing, but a lot of this stuff stems from privacy and, people's access to their own data. But if they can't control it, how do you have a governing entity help manage these companies, let alone one company, but all the tech companies?
I would not be surprised if they don't even know all the data they collect. How much stuff do they collect that just sits there? They don't know what it all is. They don't know what to do with it. And then at some point in the future, they're like, oh, hey, we could use that to do this. I've seen that on a variety of platforms where, some content that I posted years ago now has, some new functionality. And it's just like, well, that functionality didn't exist when I posted the content, which means that whatever they've come up with used other data they had behind the scenes to facilitate that feature. As a consumer, like, yeah, great. I'm glad that y'all don't have to go back and recreate all this crap. But what else is in there?
I know.
And they don't even know.
And people seem to think that data collection and manipulation is a new thing. I remember when I was in college, having somebody from Walmart.
That was a long time ago.
Yeah, that was a long, long time ago. Having somebody from Walmart talk to us about how that it was really common for them to collect information and do correlation. And so they would say, so what we did is we'd look at, all of the diaper sales that happened after 7 p.m. on weekdays. And we noticed that, there was a trend where whenever you'd buy diapers, you'd also get a six-pack of some beer or something like that, right? So they started doing this correlation. So they said, in certain areas, certain times, they would do specific end caps where they would, they'd put one thing by another thing, or they would you know, basically rotate the shape of the store around people's buying habits to kind of help them, help remind them of the things they like to buy in combination, you know, and stuff like that. So it's always happened in one form or another. It's just now more recently that it's becoming, I guess, prominent and super targeted. Before, I guess that was a little bit more generic, right? They didn't know what individual human was doing what in their habits and proclivities. And now Facebook is looking at what your spouse is buying and giving you, or researching and giving you ads for that, you know, specifically for you, which I think is a whole level of interesting.
I mean, long ago they figured out, you know, put the milk and eggs at the back of the grocery store, so you have to walk past everything else that's in the store to get those couple things that you have to have.
Yeah.
And, you know, I see a lot of people that are very anti, you know, targeting of that sort of advertising and things. But to me, it's just like, I think I'd rather be more targeted. How much more can I give you so that I stop seeing useless advertisements that just piss me off? It's like, you know, I see so many things like, what demographical data did you use to determine that I would want this?
I'm waiting for the point where everything gets so integrated that I'll start doing some searches, or based on the things I'm looking at, Amazon will just send me something that it thinks I might want. And then I'll be like, whoa, that's awesome. Or no, I don't want that. And I'll just ship it back. Right.
I want them to know. Scale of computers and AI now, like, it's not just cross-referencing your habits. It's cross-referencing people similar to you's habits, and it's doing it much faster than it used to be. And, you know, not only that, there's like places, I think Target's one of them, where they've got a minimum bandwidth threshold because they want to make sure that, you know, the kids or whoever's in the store with the parents can be preoccupied on a tablet or a phone to entice them to stay longer because the kids aren't being difficult. So I know there's some places they have a policy to make sure that, you know, every person in there can get like 25 to 50 megs on their device or something. So they way overkill the bandwidth just to give that little extra to keep you to stay there. And now everybody is sharing these pools of information. So, you know, Amazon, Facebook, all these companies, they can pull this information and cross advertise to you across all these platforms. And so it's just ramping up, I think, a lot faster than it's ever been. So it will probably get to that point, Mike, where it's just going to know everything that you want.
Yeah. Yeah. And you know, now I embrace it. I have to say that I'll always embrace it. You know, I do think that there should be some sort of, you know, universal toggle. You know, so many things now, it's like, you know, every app you install, it's like, you know, we need all these permissions. Well, you know, what if I don't want to give any app location permission?
You could use your browser then, I guess.
You know, just turn off location. But like, you know, some sort of central thing, like, you know, so I don't have to go to then every app on my phone or Target and Walmart and, you know, whatever, you know, Lowe's and Home Depot and every single one, and, you know, opt out of your newsletter, say I don't want this, or I said, you know, maybe I do want that, but maybe I don't. So, you know, maybe there needs to be some sort of central, you know, leave me alone registry. And, you know,
do not advertise registry.
Yeah, like, you know, hopefully it's more effective than the, you know, do not call registry. But you know, something like that, where it's like, you know, in the US, you have to, you know, if you're going to be tracking someone's data or whatever that could, you know, that could possibly identify them, you know, you have to check this database and see if they are willing to allow you to do that or not without even asking you. Just, all right, they said nope. You know, new app that, you know, TikTok starts up and say, like, okay, well, I already know, you know, Mike never allows his camera to be used. So, you know, he doesn't get a camera to use TikTok.
All right. Well, I think we've beaten that one into the ground.
Yeah, it's probably half the show right there.
Yeah, I know. Well, this is to put a warning. Hey, there's a lot of musings towards the end. So one of the things we had talked about was, would it be cool if we got a service that actually put timestamps on the YouTube videos and possibly the podcast? I'd be anybody that's listening that would be keen for that. I'm happy to do that. If there's some service out there that does it, I don't know that I can force myself to do it. I'm pretty sure I can't. So if there's a way I can pay somebody to do it.
I think we tried that for like two episodes one time. They did it for two or three times and was like, this is, don't have the time to do that.
I know. That kind of stuff makes me want to slip my wrist. I can't stand it. But I'm glad we pay somebody else to do it.
I wonder if there's something on like Fiverr or something like that where there's people that provide that kind of service. So at least you can, not necessarily hire them, but at least they can figure out this is what it costs to have somebody do this. So then, open up to our community. Hey, versus paying some random person in Bangladesh to do it.
You got to think it's only twice a month you got to do it. It's not that bad. Put it on 2x speed. Just wait till you hear, change the conversation, put a timestamp. I'd be down. So if you guys know of a service or you know somebody who likes, or was they a masochist or something, then let us know. Drop us a line.
Then we know we at least have one person that listens through every episode from start to finish.
All the way through.
Because we pay them to.
Well, I mean, sometimes you got to pay to feel good about yourself. It's all good. Whatever gets you through the day. All right. Let's put a fork in it, huh? Mikey.
Sure.
If people out on the internet want to get a hold of you, how would you have them go about that?
PayPal.com/, I don't know what my name is. M. Hammett, maybe? I don't know.
Well, get it together, bud.
Someone's getting money. Might not be you, though.
I think I used to say that a long time ago. And then I just realized that I didn't have time. Even if you paid me. So then I just started redirecting to the Patreon so someone else can help.
Okay. So Mike is very nondescript. Nick, do you have something more specific if you want people to get a hold of you? Nick is a talented software developer. He's a great consultant. Amazing hair right now. We talked about getting him cornrows. He's interested.
Well, you're interested. Me, not so much.
I would be interested in any hairstyle if it existed on my head. That would be all right. Nick, how would you have folks get a hold of you?
Well, the Brothers with Slack channel or nick.a@hey.com.
Excellent.
Nice and easy. No PayPal. So,
no, he sends you that later. You can get a hold of me at greg@gregsoul.com. I very regularly blog. You can throw any questions, comments that direction or contact us at the Brothers List. That works too. Let's see what else. The Patreon, patreon.com/thebrotherswist. You can throw us a couple of bones, get access to the Patreon only Slack, and also potentially pay somebody to put in timestamps, which I am happy to do. I guess if you guys have any questions or comments, please throw them at us, and we'll see you guys next time. Bye.
See ya.
All right, we're going to come over here. We're going to hit stop.
I'm apparently paypal.me/mhammett. Some good comedy given. If you missed the show already, don't worry, you're forgiven.